themselves and the consumer and make it free, or even less than free. In essence, they're not just building a moat. Google is also scorching the earth for 250 miles around the outside of the castle to ensure no one can approach it. Supply operations were the protected treasure within the fortified castle, and Android's development policies were key to the success of this supply strategy. Unlike the iPhone, the Android platform was open source, which made it easy for applications developers around the world to create apps for Android users. Eventually, Google bundled this valuable new universe of apps into its Google Play Store. Manufacturers who wanted to pre-install Google Play on their devices were required to license and install Google's mobile services as exclusive or default capabilities. Search, Gmail, Google Pay, YouTube, Google Maps, Google Photos, and whatever other supply routes happened to be in ascendance at the time. In 2016, Google's Android practices became the focus of a European Union antitrust investigation, and its complaints were a mirror image of Google's purposeful construction and protection of vital supply routes in search and mobile. Once again, governmental opposition to Google's monopolistic activities emphasized traditional competitive harms at the expense of surveillance capitalism's new harms. By April of 2013, Eric Schmidt told a conference devoted to all things digital that, "Our goal with Android is to reach everyone. We'll cross 1 billion Android devices in 6 to 9 months. In a year or two, we'll hit 2 billion. A relatively inexpensive smartphone with a browser is all you need to get the world's information." That final sentence presumably was intended to describe benefits to Android's users. However, it is an even more effective summary of Google's own ambitions and an insight into the vital economies of scale associated with this mobile supply route. Google fiercely defends threatened supply routes. Any disruption of its extraction operations and its exclusive claims to raw material is the line that cannot be breached. In 2009, Android manufacturer Motorola chose to replace Google's free location services with those of Skyhook Wireless, which Motorola believed produced more reliable results. A Google product manager admitted Skyhook's superiority, but expressed his concerns in an email to a Google executive, noting that if other manufacturers switched to Skyhook, it would be awful for Google because it will cut off our ability to continue collecting data for the company's Wi-Fi location database. Court documents from Skyhook's eventual lawsuit against Motorola and Samsung include an email from Google's senior vice president of mobile to Motorola's CEO, insisting that the interruption of Google's data collection was a stop-ship issue. Another legal fracas further illustrates how products such as Android are valued more for supply than for sales. Disconnect Inc., founded in 2011 by two former Google engineers and a privacy rights attorney, developed desktop and mobile applications to protect the privacy and security of Internet users by blocking invisible, unsolicited network connections between a user's browser or mobile device and sites or services that engage in invisible tracking or are known or suspected distributors of malware, not only when he browses the web, but also when he uses other third-party mobile applications. Disconnect specifically took aim at the invisible, unsolicited, and frequently undisclosed network connections from third-party sites and services that occur as soon as you visit a website or open a mobile application. Unfortunately for Disconnect, the very process that it aimed to impede had been established as a significant supply route for Google and other surveillance capitalists. Several studies explain the extent of Google's extraction architecture, including the Web Privacy Census, which primarily measured cookies. The census analyzed the top 100, 1,000, and 25,000 websites in 2011, 2012, and 2015, years of feverish discovery and elaboration for surveillance capitalists. The comparisons between 2012 and 2015 revealed more than twice as many sites with 100 or more cookies and more than 3 times the number of sites with 150 or more cookies. In 2015, the team found that anyone who simply visited the 100 most popular websites would collect over 6,000 cookies in his or her computer, 83% of which were from third parties unrelated to the website that was visited. The census found Google tracking infrastructure on 92 of the top 100 sites and 923 of the top 1,000 sites, concluding that Google's ability to track users on popular websites is unparalleled, and it approaches the level of surveillance that only an internet service provider can achieve. Another 2015 analysis, this one of the top 1 million websites by Timothy Liebert of the University of Pennsylvania, found that 90% leak data to an average of 9 external domains that track, capture, and expropriate user data for commercial purposes. Among these websites, 78% initiate third-party transfers to a domain owned by one company, Google. Another 34% transfer to a Facebook-owned domain. Stephen Engelhardt and Arvind Narayanan from Princeton University reported in 2016 on the results of their measurement and analysis of tracking data from 1 million websites. They identified 81,000 third parties, but only 123 of those are present on more than 1% of sites. Of that group, the top 5 third parties and 12 of the top 20 are Google-owned domains. In fact, they conclude, Google, Facebook, and Twitter are the only third-party entities present on more than 10% of sites. Chinese researchers investigated 10,000 apps from the top third-party app markets in 2017. They found a covert process in which an app autonomously launches other apps in the background of your phone, and they concluded that this app collusion was most prevalent in third-party Android markets. Of the 1,000 top apps on one of China's popular platforms, 822 launched an average of 76 other apps, and of these launches, 77% were triggered by cloud-based push services that are intended to update apps, but are obviously doing a lot more. In the Android environment, the researchers note, Google provides the push service. Finally, extraordinary research from the French nonprofit Exodus Privacy and the Yale Privacy Lab in 2017 documented the exponential proliferation of tracking software. Exodus identified 44 trackers in more than 300 apps for Google's Android platform, some of which are also produced for Apple's operating system. Altogether, these apps have been downloaded billions of times. Two themes stand out in the research report: ubiquity and intensification. First, there is hardly an innocent app. If it's not tracking you now, it may be doing so in the next week or month. There is an entire industry based upon these trackers, and apps identified as clean today may contain trackers that have not yet been identified. Tracker code may also be added by developers to new versions of apps in the future. Second is that even the most innocent-seeming applications, such as weather, flashlights, ride-sharing, and dating apps, are infested with dozens of tracking programs that rely on increasingly bizarre, aggressive, and illegible tactics to collect massive amounts of behavioral surplus, ultimately directed at ad targeting. For example, the ad tracker FidsUp developed communication between a sonic emitter and a mobile phone. It can detect the presence of mobile phones, and therefore their owners, by diffusing a tone, inaudible to the human ear, inside a building. Users installing Bottin Gourmand, a guide to restaurants and hotels in France, would thus have their physical location tracked via retail outlet speakers as they moved around Paris. Their experience would be shared by readers of a car magazine app, Auto Journal, and the TV guide app Telestar. In a pattern foreshadowed by the Google patent that we examined in Chapter 3, and that we shall see repeatedly in the coming chapters, The research findings emphasize that the always-on tracking is impervious to the Android permissions system, despite its promises of user control. Given the hostility and intensity of these supply operations, it is not too surprising that Disconnect software was banned from Google Play's vast catalog of mobile apps, leading to Disconnect's lawsuit against Google in 2015. The startup's complaint explains that advertising companies, including Google, use these invisible connections to track the user as he or she browses the web or opens other mobile applications, in order to collect personal information about the user, create a profile of the user, and make money targeting advertising to the user. It went on to argue that the privacy protections offered by Google invariably permit the company to continue to gather private information. Google's ban of the Disconnect app is exceptionally revealing in light of the fact that, unlike Apple, Google is notoriously libertarian when it comes to the millions of apps sold or downloaded for free from its App Store. Its loose guidelines attempt to identify and exclude malicious applications, but little else. Disconnect's founders attempted to challenge the extraction imperative, but they could not do so alone. After trying, without success, to negotiate with Google, they eventually joined other organizations in filing a complaint against Google in the EU, helping to precipitate an Android-focused antitrust probe. As Disconnect argued, Google is under enormous pressure from the financial community to increase the effectiveness of its tracking so that it can increase revenues and profits. Giving a user the ability to control his own privacy information and to protect himself from malware by blocking invisible connections to problematic sites constitutes an existential threat to Google. As ex-Googlers, the founders of Disconnect thought that they knew their adversary well, but they underestimated the progress of surveillance capitalism's institutionalization and the ferocity with which the corporation was prepared to fend off existential threats to its supply routes. 3. The dispossession cycle. Long before Disconnect, Google had discovered that successful dispossession is not a single action, but rather an intricate convergence of political, social, administrative, and technical operations that requires cunning management over a substantial period of time. Its dispossession operations reveal a predictable sequence of stages that must be crafted and orchestrated in great detail in order to achieve their ultimate destination as a system of facts through which surplus extraction is normalized. The four stages of the cycle are incursion, habituation, adaptation, and redirection. Taken together, these stages constitute a theory of change that describes and predicts dispossession as a political and cultural operation supported by an elaborate range of administrative, technical, and material capabilities. There are many vivid examples of this cycle, including Google's Gmail. Google's efforts to establish supply routes in social networks, first with Buzz and then with Google Plus, and the company's development of Google Glass. In this chapter, we focus on the Street View narrative for a close look at the dispossession cycle and its management challenges. The first stage of successful dispossession is initiated by unilateral incursion into undefended space. Your laptop, your phone, a web page, the street where you live, an email to your friend, your walk in the park, browsing online for a birthday gift, sharing photos of your kids, your interests and tastes, your digestion, your tears, your attention, your feelings, your face. The incursion is when dispossession operations rely on their virtual capabilities to kidnap behavioral surplus from the non-market spaces of everyday life where it lives. The incursion initiates Google's most basic and prolific form of dispossession, Arendt's repeated original sin of simple robbery. Incursion moves down the road without looking left or right, continuously laying claim to decision rights over whatever is in its path. "I'm taking this," it says. "These are mine now." The company has learned to launch incursions and proceed until resistance is encountered. It then seduces, ignores, overwhelms, or simply exhausts its adversaries. Seduction means a cascade of golden enticements. Unprecedented storage, access to new qualities of information, new conveniences. When necessary, the company can just as easily pivot toward harsher tactics that aim to deplete its adversaries' time, money, and grit. There are hundreds of cases launched against Google by countries, states, groups, and individuals, and there are many more cases that never become public. According to Mark Rotenberg, executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, no one knows precisely how many lawsuits there are around the world. The legal challenges are varied, but they nearly always come back to the same thing: unilateral incursion met by resistance. Legal opposition and social protest have surfaced in relation to the digitalization of books, the collection of personal information through Street View's Wi-Fi and camera capabilities, the capture of voice communications, the bypassing of privacy settings, the manipulation of search results, the extensive retention of search data, the tracking of smartphone location data, wearable technologies and facial recognition capabilities, the secret collection of student data for commercial purposes, and the consolidation of user profiles across all Google's services and devices, just to name several instances. Expect to see drones, body sensors, neurotransmitters, digital assistants, and other censored devices on this list in the years to come. Meanwhile, Google is consistently stunning in its sense of entitlement, resolve, and audacity. The extraction imperative compels it to push new boundaries into undefended space. In a second stage, the aim is habituation. Whereas lawsuits and investigations unwind at the tedious pace of democratic institutions, Google continues the development of its contested practices at high velocity. During the elapsed time of FTC and FCC inquiries, court cases, judicial reviews, and EU Commission investigations, the new contested practices become more firmly established as institutional facts, rapidly bolstered by growing ecosystems of stakeholders. People habituate to the incursion with some combination of agreement, helplessness, and resignation. The sense of astonishment and outrage dissipates. The incursion itself, once unthinkable, slowly worms its way into the ordinary. Worse still, it gradually comes to seem inevitable. New dependencies develop. As populations grow numb, it becomes more difficult for individuals and groups to complain. In a third stage of the cycle, when Google is occasionally forced to alter its practices, its executives and engineers produce superficial but tactically effective adaptations that satisfy the immediate demands of government authorities, court rulings, and public opinion. Meanwhile, in a final stage, the corporation regroups to cultivate new rhetoric, methods, and design elements that redirect contested supply operations just enough so that they appear to be compliant with social and legal demands. The creativity, financial resources, and determination brought to the task of managing this staged process are flexible and dynamic. In contrast, the operational necessity for economies of scale in the capture of behavioral surplus is a perpetual motion machine whose implacable rhythms offer no room for divergence. The theory and practice of dispossession were developed and refined as the company learned how to counter and transform public resistance as an essential condition for the protection and expansion of its behavioral surplus franchise. Google's launch of Gmail on April Fool's Day, 2004, provided an early occasion to climb this learning curve as the corporation faced down public outrage over the automated scanning of email content intended as a fresh source of surplus for targeted ads. Eventually, the dispossession cycle was refined as an explicit theory of change that framed a tactical game plan which is by now regularly evoked as the surveillance capitalist corporation's battle-tested response to societal resistance. The dispossession cycle at Google was so successful in facing down the threats to Gmail that it was replicated and further elaborated in the battles over Google Street View, the street mapping operation launched in 2007. Once again, the company did not ask permission. It simply repeated the original sin of simple robbery and took what it wanted, waiting for resistance to run its course as it devoured and datafied the world's public spaces, streets, buildings, and homes. Stage 1. Incursion. Street View first entered public awareness with an apparently benign blog post. Peter Fleischer, Google's privacy counsel, helped launch the new service by writing a paean celebrating America's noble tradition of public spaces, where, he claimed, people don't have the same expectations of privacy as they do in their homes. As a lawyer, Fleischer knows the work that words do in establishing contracts and setting precedents, so it pays to read his 2007 words with care. His casually declarative prose undertakes some extraordinary work as he asserts that all public spaces are fair game for Google's taking. In his account, any public space is a fitting subject for the firm's new breed of incursion without authorization, knowledge, or agreement. Homes, streets, neighborhoods, villages, towns, cities. They are no longer local scenes where neighbors live and walk, where residents meet and talk. Google Street View, we are informed, claims every place as just another object among objects in an infinite grid of GPS coordinates and camera angles. In his declaration, Fleischer intends to establish Google's prerogative to empty every place of the subjective meanings that unite the human beings who gather there. Yes, when we leave our home, we know we will be seen, but we expect to be seen by one another in spaces that we choose. Instead, it's all impersonal spectacle now. My house, my street, my neighborhood, my favorite cafe, each is redefined as a living tourist brochure, surveillance target, and strip mine, an object for universal inspection and commercial expropriation. Google had already taken everything on the web, but Street View and Google's other mapping operations, Google Maps and Google Earth, the company's 3D view of the world using satellite and aerial imagery, announced an even more ambitious vision. Everything in the world was to be known and rendered by Google, accessed through Google, and indexed by Google in its infinite appetite for behavioral surplus. The presumption is that nothing is beyond Google's borders. The world is vanquished now, on its knees, and brought to you by Google. The blog post that accompanied Street View is a precise replica of the invaders who once landed on that blameless Caribbean beach. Those adelantados concealed the bare facts of invasion in elaborate gestures of friendship and humility that made it impossible to discern the clear and present danger implicit in their arrival. Fleischer similarly assures his audience of friendly terms. Street View, which used cartoonishly wrapped cars with a large 360-degree camera mount on the roof to capture the imagery it sought, was designed to respect the privacy of people who happen to be walking down a public street, Fleischer wrote. That's why we designed a simple process for anyone to contact us and have their image removed. And he promised that it would respect laws and customs in other parts of the world. Resistance came swiftly and often. By January 2009, Street View was facing opposition in Germany and Japan. John Hanke, by then the vice president for Google Maps-related products, dismissed the uproar. You will recall that Hanke had founded the CIA-funded satellite mapping company, Keyhole, and after Google's purchase, he led its transformation into Google Earth. He told a reporter that it was all simply part of a cycle of people understanding exactly what it is and what it isn't, and what they shouldn't really be concerned about. In other words, the dispossession cycle. Google Earth was also under fire, blamed for aiding a deadly terrorist attack in Mumbai. But Hanke insisted that the debate over Google Earth or Street View had mostly died off in the West. He cleverly equated any resistance to Google's incursions with the anti-freedom of expression interests of authoritarian governments and their closed information societies. This would become a standard rhetorical device for Google and its allies as they executed their offense. Was Hanke surprised then when, in April 2009, residents of the quiet English village of Broughton blocked a Street View car that tried to breach the village perimeter, calling it an unwelcome intrusion? This was the West, after all. But the debate over privacy, self-determination, and decision rights was anything but dead. Privacy International submitted a formal complaint to the UK Privacy Authority, citing more than 200 reports from people who were identifiable on Street View images, and demanded that the service be suspended. Google's executives had apparently missed Fleischer's memo on respecting privacy claims. Instead, Hanke dismissed the protesters out of hand. He told the London Times that the company was undeterred and planned to complete coverage of the UK by the end of that year. He declared that Street View's information was good for the economy and good for us as individuals. It is about giving people powerful information so that they can make better choices. Hanke's remarks were wishful thinking, of course, but they were consistent with Google's wider practice. It's great to empower people, but not too much, lest they notice the pilfering of their decision rights and try to reclaim them. The firm wants to enable people to make better choices, but not if those choices impede Google's own imperatives. Google's ideal society is a population of distant users, not a citizenry. It idealizes people who are informed, but only in the ways that the corporation chooses. It means for us to be docile, harmonious, and, above all, grateful. In 2010, the German Federal Commission for Data Protection announced that Google's Street View operation actually camouflaged a covert data sweep. Street View cars were secretly collecting personal data from private Wi-Fi networks. Google denied the charge, insisting that it was gathering only publicly broadcast Wi-Fi network names and the identifying addresses of Wi-Fi routers, but not personal information sent over the network. Within days, an independent analysis by German security experts proved decisively that Street View's cars were extracting unencrypted personal information from homes. Google was forced to concede that it had intercepted and stored payload data, personal information grabbed from unencrypted Wi-Fi transmissions. As its apologetic blog post noted, in some instances, entire emails and URLs were captured, as well as passwords. Technical experts in Canada, France, and the Netherlands discovered that the payload data included names, telephone numbers, credit information, passwords, messages, emails, and chat transcripts, as well as records of online dating, pornography, browsing behavior, medical information, location data, photos, and video and audio files. They concluded that such data packets could be stitched together for a detailed profile of an identifiable person. Google's SpyFi scandal filled headlines around the world. Many believed that the Street View revelations would inflict irreparable damage to Google. In Germany, where the firm's actions were in clear violation of privacy and data protection laws, officials reacted angrily and warned that Google would face EU investigations and consequences in the German courts. A bill was introduced into the German parliament that proposed to fine Google for displaying personal property without owner's consent. Google faced fresh litigation in Switzerland, Canada, France, and the Netherlands. By 2012, there were multiple investigations in 12 countries, including most of Europe, the North Atlantic, and Australia, and Google had been found guilty of violating laws in at least 9 countries. In the U.S., attorneys general from 38 states launched a probe into Google's Street View practices. Private citizens filed numerous class action suits, 8 of which were consolidated in the Northern California United States District Court. The head of Privacy International said that Google was becoming Big Brother. The Electronic Privacy Information Center championed substantial legal resistance in the U.S. against Google's efforts to avoid repercussions in the wake of the SpyFi scandal. And it maintained a detailed and continuously updated online overview of the worldwide outrage, protests, investigations, litigation, and settlements in response to Google Street View and its extraction tactics. Google characterized Street View's privacy violations as a mistake made by a single engineer working on an experimental project, whose code had inadvertently made it into Street View's software. The firm refused to release the identity of the mystery engineer and insisted that the project's leaders were unaware of the data capture and had no intention of using those data. As Eric Schmidt told the Financial Times, "We screwed up," noting that the engineer in question would face an internal investigation for his clear violation of Google's policies. Unbowed, Schmidt insisted on the validity of Google's mission to index all the world's information. A 2012 investigation by the Federal Communications Commission described the case as a deliberate software design decision by one of the Google employees working on the Street View project. The engineer had been selected for the team because of his unique expertise in Wi-Fi war driving, the practice of driving around using equipment to locate wireless networks. His design notes indicated that user traffic and location data would be logged along with information about what they are doing that would be analyzed offline for use in other initiatives. The notes identified, but then dismissed, privacy considerations. The FCC found evidence that contradicted Google's scapegoating narrative. The records showed that the engineer had emailed links to his software documentation to project leaders, who then shared them with the entire Street View team. It also found evidence that on at least 2 occasions, the engineer told his colleagues that Street View was collecting personal data. Despite these facts, along with evidence of the company's exhaustive internal software reviews and testing procedures, and the regular transfer of payload data from Street View's hard disks to Google's Oregon data center, Google's engineers denied any knowledge of personal data collection. Stage 2. Habituation. Hanke's bet that the cycle would eventually wear down resistance reflects a key operational component of the extraction imperative, discovered in search, refined with Gmail, and elaborated with Street View. The messages that come through are, "Don't look back, wait them out, step on them if necessary." The April 2012 FCC report is heart-wrenching in its way, a melancholic depiction of democracy's vulnerability in the face-off with a wealthy, determined, and audacious surveillance capitalist opponent. In November 2010, the FCC sent Google a letter of inquiry requesting necessary information. Little was forthcoming. By March of the next year, a second supplemental letter was sent. Google's response was incomplete information and lack of cooperation, which produced another demand letter in August. Google's continued lack of engagement required yet another letter in late October. The FCC staff was burdened with following up and chasing down evasive corporate executives and their representatives for an entire year. The document is a revelation of negative space and a saga of democracy rebuffed. The FCC's detailed initial request produced only 5 documents and no emails. The corporation said that it had no time to undertake a comprehensive review, calling it burdensome. Google failed to identify relevant individuals. It redacted names. It asserted that the information requested serves no useful purpose. It failed to verify information. When asked for specific submissions, Google did not do so. Google argued that it should not be required to provide access to the payload data it had illicitly collected. Google waited. The phrases failed to respond and failed to provide are repeated throughout the account. Google violated commission orders, delaying. Affidavits were requested 5 times, but the company did not provide any of these until September 2011, after the FCC threatened a subpoena. The mystery engineer simply refused to speak with investigators, citing his Fifth Amendment right to avoid self-incrimination. As the report concludes, there is evidence that Google's failure to cooperate with the Bureau was in many or all cases deliberate. It might have said imperative. Ultimately, the corporation's lawyers prevailed, defending Google's data sweeps with a single obscure passage in a decades-old wiretap law. Perhaps the most telling element of the entire episode is that the same democratic system of laws and rules that the corporation openly treated with scorn was invoked to protect it from accountability. In the end, the FCC fined Google only $25,000 for obstructing its investigation. Google did not evade legal consequences because society agreed with its practices, but because there was not enough relevant law to protect citizens from its incursions. The 38 attorneys general did not fare much better. When the group's leader, Connecticut's Richard Blumenthal, issued a civil investigative demand, equivalent to a subpoena, to get access to the infamous private data, Google ignored it. The company finally agreed to settle with the states in 2013, accepting a mere $7 million fine and a series of agreements regarding aggressive self-policing. The New York Times announced that Google had finally admitted that it had violated people's privacy during its Street View mapping project when it casually scooped up personal information, as if this scandal had been the only contested element in the whole affair. State officials crowed that the industry giant is committing to change its corporate culture to encourage sensitivity to issues of personal data privacy. In light of the fact that the extraction imperative is what makes this giant a giant, one doesn't know whether to laugh or cry at the confidence of the attorneys general in Google's commitment to privacy self-regulation. There are 2 key elements here that illuminate habituation tactics. The first is the simple fact of the elapsed time between Street View's initial incursion in 2007, the 2010 scandal, the 2012 conclusion of the FCC inquiry, and the 2013 conclusion of the state's investigation. The German investigation also closed in late 2012, with little to show for its trouble. Other contests and lawsuits lumbered on. Despite all the sound and fury, Google continued to operate Street View during those years. Between 2008 and 2010, 600 billion bytes of personal information were collected illegitimately around the world. 200 billion of those in the U.S. The corporation said that it had discontinued personal data collection. Had it? Can anyone say with certainty? Even if it had, the original incursion that was Street View continued unscathed. The second point is that, in retrospect, one sees that the very idea of a single rogue engineer was designed and elaborated as a brilliant piece of misdirection, a classic scapegoating ploy. It directed attention away from the ambitious and controversial agenda of the extraction imperative, toward a different narrative of a single infected cell excised from the flesh of an enormous but innocent organism. All that was left was to excise the infected flesh and let the organism declare itself cured of its privacy kleptomania. Then, a return to the streets, born again. Google achieved exactly what Hanke had predicted. Street View's fundamental audacity, The unprecedented, astonishing incursion that drew English villagers into the streets to block a Google camera car enjoyed 6 more years of rooting in global consciousness. The corporation's strategic discipline when it comes to stonewalling, snubbing, and exploiting democracy brought 6 more years of people using Street View data and 6 more years to build the tacit case for Google's inevitability and our helplessness. There were 6 more years for this simple robbery of decision rights to shade into normalcy and even to be reckoned as convenient, useful, or marvelous. Stage 3. Adaptation. In October 2010, just before the corporation received the FCC's first letter of inquiry, Google's senior vice president of engineering and research announced stronger privacy controls in an official Google blog post. "We've failed badly here," he said. The Street View scandal was framed as an inadvertent error, a single blemish on a company that works hard to earn your trust. The post assured the public that the corporation was talking to external regulators about possible improvements to our policies and promised that it would make changes to ensure user privacy. Alma Witten, a Google executive with credentials in computer security and privacy controls, was appointed as director of privacy across engineering and product management. The blog also introduced a new internal training emphasis on responsible collection, use, and handling of user data. Finally, the post pledged new internal controls to oversee how data are handled. "We are mortified by what happened," it read, "but confident that these changes to our processes and structure will significantly improve our internal privacy and security practices for the benefit of all our users." Though pledging reform to the public, the corporation was simultaneously forced to adapt to governmental demands in a range of countries, including Australia, Belgium, Canada, France, Holland, Hong Kong, Ireland, Israel, Italy, New Zealand, Poland, Spain, South Korea, the UK, and the US, where Street View was subjected to litigation, fines, and/or regulation. In Japan, homeowners complained of Street View cameras that peered above privacy fencing to record private homes. Google agreed to government demands to lower its cameras, reshoot all images, and blur identifiable facial images and license plates. In Germany, Google allowed residents to request that their homes be blurred in any Street View images. Nearly 250,000 households made opt-out requests in 2009 to 2010, requiring Google to hire 200 temporary programmers to meet the demand. Google was fined €145,000 by the Hamburg Data Protection Supervisor, who had first discovered the Street View illicit data gathering, just short of the €150,000 fee he could have imposed. It was the largest fine ever to have been levied by European regulators for privacy concerns. The discount reflected Google's assurances that it would swiftly and thoroughly delete the payload data. In 2011, Google ended its Street View program in Germany, continuing to support but no longer update the images it had already collected. Other countries imposed bans on Street View operations. Switzerland initially banned the service in 2009, insisting that Google remove all imagery it had posted of Swiss towns and cities. Eventually, the ban was lifted, but the Swiss Federal Administrative Court imposed a series of strict guidelines, including blurring faces, instituting opt-out measures, and reducing camera heights. By 2016, Google's service remained confined to outdoor tourist sites. The corporation also faced Street View bans in Australia, the Czech Republic, Greece, India, and Lithuania. By the summer of 2017, though, Street View data were available from at least some regions of each of these countries. Stage 4. Redirection. What Google did not say in its mea culpa blog post, the one thing that it could not say, was that it would abandon its fundamental logic of accumulation. The principles of surveillance capitalism that had brought the behemoth into existence and sustained its growth. The message of Street View's redirection campaign was that Google would not exempt anything from the grid. Everything must be corralled for conversion into raw material. Short of its institutional suicide, there is little that Google can say or do to ensure user privacy. This helps explain why, as one 2015 article celebrating the history of Google Maps observes, Google Maps was attracting all sorts of privacy controversies. People were freaked out. But that doesn't mean Street View has been tamped down as a project. It's now available in 65 of Google Maps' 200-some countries. Alma Witten's job was to repair Google's privacy reputation, not to dismantle the extraction imperative and its relentless demand for economies of scale in the supply function. This is to say that her job was a logical impossibility. That she may have nevertheless taken it seriously is suggested by the fact that just 2.5 years after her appointment as privacy czar, she announced her retirement from Google in April 2013. Indeed, it is painful to watch Witten testify about Google's practices to an early 2013 congressional hearing. She was under questioning from Congress, and one sees the effort required as she hunts for the words to convey an answer without conveying the truth. The time had come to regroup and redirect the global mapping project, not to end it. That nothing much had changed or would change was immediately suggested by the fate of Google's mystery engineer in the 2 years that followed the scandal. Within days of the FCC report in April 2012, a former state investigator who had been assigned to the Street View inquiry identified Google's rogue actor as Marius Milner, a celebrated hacker and war-driving specialist. It had been 2 years since the supposedly irreparable damage that he inflicted on Google and his clear violation of policy, yet he continued to be employed at the firm in its YouTube operations. Later that year, he would be one of 6 inventors on a team led by John Hankey to patent a system and method for transporting virtual objects in a parallel reality game. The invention in which Milner participated was related to a virtual reality game called Ingress, also developed by Hankey and his team at Google. Hankey would eventually establish his own shop, Niantic Labs, within Google's new Alphabet holding company. Ingress became a testbed for many of the foundational concepts that reappeared in another game, Pokemon Go, a prototype of a second phase of surveillance capitalist expansion that we examine closely in Part 2. In this next phase, Google's maps are a critical resource for the expansion of digital dispossession from the virtual world to the one that we call real. In light of those plans, Street View could not be allowed to die or even to be constrained. The corporation's senior product manager for Google Maps framed it succinctly in September 2012, just 4 months after the FCC investigation. If you look at the offline world, the real world in which we live, that information is not entirely online. Increasingly, as we go about our lives, we are trying to bridge that gap between what we see in the real world and the online world. And Maps really plays that part. Google's closely guarded Ground Truth project, initiated in 2008, but only publicly revealed just 4 months after the FCC report in 2012, exemplifies the point. Ground Truth is the deep map that contains the detailed logic of places. Walking paths, goldfish ponds, highway on-ramps, traffic conditions, ferry lines, parks, campuses, neighborhoods, buildings, and more. Getting these details right is a source of competitive advantage in the contest for behavioral surplus accrued from mobile devices. The construction of the deep map draws on public resources such as geographic databases from the U.S. Census Bureau and the U.S. Geological Survey. But what distinguishes Google's maps from all others is the integration of its exclusive proprietary data from Street View. In other words, data compiled through public investments are augmented with data taken from a unilateral transfer of surplus behavior and decision rights. The composite results are then reclassified as private assets. One of the first journalists invited to see demonstrations of ground truth in 2012, Alexis Madrigal, observed that the maps team, largely driven by Street View, is publishing more imagery data every 2 weeks than Google possessed in total in 2006. Google is up to 5 million miles driven now. Street View cars are likened to Google Search's early web crawlers, which quietly commandeered web pages for indexing and access in the corporation's original act of dispossession. By 2012, Street View data also provided street signs and addresses. Soon, Madrigal wrote, any word that is visible from a road will become a part of Google's index of the physical world, thanks to Street View. Madrigal's look at the ground truth operation concludes, the geographic data Google has assembled is not likely to be matched by any other company. They've built this whole playground as an elaborate lore for you. As one project leader put it, the challenge of deciding you're going to map the world is that you can't ever stop. So it was that by 2016, Google's Street View website celebrated its successful evolution by stating, "We've come a long way since our initial U.S. launch in 2007. Today we've expanded our 360-degree panoramic views to include locations on all 7 continents." Street View's fleet of surveillance gathering tools had been augmented to include a wearable backpack, a 3-wheeled pedicab, a snowmobile, and a trolley, all of which were designed to capture places that Street View cars could not traverse. Tourist boards and nonprofits were offered the use of the company's trekker equipment, the backpack camera, to collect views of remote and unique places that were literally and figuratively off the grid. What Google couldn't build, it bought. In 2013, the corporation won a reported bidding war with Facebook for Israeli social mapping startup Waze, a firm that pioneered community-sourced real-time traffic information. In 2014, it acquired real-time satellite imaging startup Skybox, just as the U.S. Department of Commerce lifted restrictions on high-resolution satellite imagery. As an expert explained, if you imagine a satellite above your office, then the old resolution could probably make out your desk. The new imagery, where each pixel measures around 31 centimeters, can now make out what's on your desk. When you reach for this sort of frequency, you can begin to add in what we call pattern of life analysis. This means looking at activity in terms of movement, not just identification. In this context, one appreciates the significance of another aspect of Google's redirection campaign, a 2011 announcement that the corporation had breached a new frontier with the introduction of an indoor positioning system that enabled it to locate and follow people when you're inside an airport, shopping mall, or retail store. Eventually, these new capabilities would include sensors and embedded cameras that let users map and navigate interior spaces. In a September 2014 blog, Google Maps' dynamic new capabilities were showcased to the public as your new co-pilot for deciding everything from turn-by-turn directions to discovering new restaurants to deciding which hiking trails to climb. The post credits Street View with providing these wondrous new capabilities and announces the expansion of the whole incursion with the introduction of a mobile mapping tool dubbed Cartographer, worn as a backpack and able to map the interior of buildings. Cartographer's information could be added to the growing navigational database of interior spaces, amplifying Google's ability to locate people and devices as they moved between outdoor and indoor spaces. Building interiors had eluded street view and the extraction imperative. Few homeowners were likely to invite those cameras indoors. Instead, cartographers' capabilities were bundled into the larger Street View redirection campaign and pitched to businesses as a way to enhance consumer trust, allay anxiety, and substantially increase revenues. Google exhorted consumer-facing businesses to invite customers inside. With its business view, consumers would be able to see inside thousands of hotels, restaurants, and other destinations. Search listings would feature the new Street View content. Hotel listings would offer a virtual tour of the properties. Give them the confidence they're seeking, Google told its business marketplace, by allowing consumers to experience your location before they arrive. Google asserted that virtual tours double bookings, and it instated a certification program that enabled businesses to hire a Google-approved freelance photographer to produce images for Street View. These extraordinary new redirection tactics aimed to flip the old pattern. They reframed Street View from an edgy incursion circumventing resistance through stealth to an opulent VIP tent where businesses scrambled for an entry pass. Street View's redirection and elaboration announced a critical shift in the orientation and ambition of the surveillance program. It would no longer be only about routes, but about routing. We will examine this new episode of Dispossession in the chapters that follow. For now, suffice to say that Street View and the larger project of Google Maps illustrate the new and even more ambitious goals toward which this cycle of dispossession would soon point. The migration from an online data source to a real-world monitor, to an advisor, to an active shepherd. From knowledge to influence to control. Ultimately, Street View's elaborate data would become the basis for another complex of spectacular Google incursions, the self-driving car and Google City, which we learn more about in Chapter 7. Those programs aim to take surplus capture to new levels while opening up substantial new frontiers for the establishment of behavioral futures markets in the real world of goods and services. It is important to understand that each level of innovation builds on the one before, and that all are united in one aim, the extraction of behavioral surplus at scale. In this progression, Google perceives an opportunity that it hopes its customers will come to appreciate. Its ability to influence actual behavior as it occurs in the real spaces of everyday life. In 2016, for example, the corporation introduced a new Maps app feature called Driving Mode that suggests destinations and travel times without users even selecting where they want to go. If you searched for a hammer online, then Driving Mode can send you to a hardware store when you buckle up your seatbelt. Google is integrating this push technology into its main mobile search app, reported the Wall Street Journal. With this app, Google, the co-pilot, prompts an individual to turn left and right on a path defined by its continuously accruing knowledge of the person and the context. Predictions about where and why a person might spend money are derived from Google's exclusive access to behavior surplus and its equally exclusive analytic capabilities. Eat here, buy this. Google's surplus analysis can predict that you are likely to buy an expensive woolen suit, and its real-time location data can trigger the proprietor or advertiser's real-time prompt, matched to your profile and delivered at the very moment that you are within sight of the flannels, tweeds, and cashmeres. Push and pull, suggest, nudge, cajole, shame, seduce. Google wants to be your co-pilot for life itself. Each human response to each commercial prompt yields more data to refine into better prediction products. The prompts themselves are bought and paid for in a novel iteration of Google's online ad markets. Real-time, real-world trading in behavioral futures. Your future. The stakes are high in this market frontier, where unpredictable behavior is the equivalent of lost revenue. Google cannot leave anything to chance. In September 2016, the tech newsletter The Register revealed that the Google Play app, pre-installed in the latest Android phone, continuously checks a user's location, sending that information to your third-party apps as well.